It's always a little surreal to visit an ancient city, to enter buildings that have shaped the landscape for centuries or walk through streets that have existed for 1,000 years or more. But as inconceivably old as those places feel, they might be concealing older structures that have been invisible for so many generations, nobody alive today knows they exist. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The traditional way for archaeologists to find and study ancient human settlements has been to dig for them. Of course, excavations are a long, tedious, and extremely expensive thing to do, and no matter how carefully they're carried out, the site itself will be forever altered. But if an old-school archaeological dig is like exploratory surgery that might or might not reveal anything significant and will leave a scar, some archaeologists are thrilled by the possibilities of new technologies that promise something like a non-invasive full-body scan of the entire planet. Jeff Mano is a contributor at Wired, where you can find his article, "Scientists Have an Audacious Plan to Map the Ancient World Before It Disappears." Jeff, welcome to Think.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You introduced the piece by taking us along to visit a cathedral in Siena, Italy that has been there for 800 years, which, you know, for us Americans is pretty hard to fathom. But as it happens, this is like the new church in town, right?
It was fascinating to learn that an archaeologist I met up with there, a man named Stefano Campana, had been doing studies of pretty much the entire city of Siena. You know, his goal is to use these new tools such as radar to map basically everything that's beneath the surface of the city, going back centuries, if not even millennia. And during the COVID-19 lockdowns, he got access to the main cathedral in town. And so, you know, to an American eye, or really to the eyes of pretty much anyone, an 800-year-old cathedral is a, you know, it's a permanent landmark. It's ancient in its own right. It's more or less been there forever. But what's really interesting is that when you use these other tools, such as ground-penetrating radar or magnetometry, you can pick up signals underneath the existing buildings of things that existed there before. And so what Professor Campana and his colleagues found was that actually there are remnants and other foundation walls and evidence of other churches extending back before the cathedral that we currently visit. And, you know, buildings and other infrastructure that has been around, but it has been entirely invisible beneath the surface of the earth for, you know, centuries at a time. And it's a fascinating way to open up a window on the past.
Was there some like probable cause for them to search there? Or I know it's known that other cathedrals in Italy have earlier structures beneath them. Did they just think it was worth giving this a shot?
Well, I guess it was a combination of two things. In the practical way, there was evidence of textual evidence and references in historical sources to other structures that were attempted on the site. There was an extension of the church itself. The cathedral that you can now visit in Siena was actually at one point meant to be substantially larger. But the construction crews, as they were, putting in the foundation walls and trying to extend the church along one of its axes, found that the ground just simply wasn't stable enough to support the massive weight that you would need to put these huge, masonry blocks together and form a cathedral. And so that part of it was abandoned. And so there was, you know, evidence and there was general knowledge that there were other things in the ground there and that other churches had been tried in the past. But the main question, of course, is where would that be? You can't just go into, you know, one of the most spectacular cathedrals in Europe and just take a jackhammer to the floor and, to start tearing things down to look for what's underneath. And so you need to use the tools of what's referred to as non-invasive archaeology. So it's similar to a kind of a medical imaging technique where you can look into things without actually physically dismantling them. And you can see what's beneath them. You can see what's within them. And then just briefly, I'll say that the other thing that led them to this was that they are trying to do a scan of the entire city of Siena. And so, you know, the cathedral and its grounds would be part of that. And so that was part of a much larger and more ambitious project as well.
So I want to just do a little sidebar here. On our timescales, Jeff, no cities that we encounter seem at risk of disappearing under the soil. How does it happen that ancient settlements get buried in the first place?
Sure. So, yeah, that question comes up a lot because it does seem to, you know, are people just shoveling dirt over their houses as they leave, or, you know, what exactly is happening? But, you know, what you have is a combination of a few different processes. So one is that, you know, as you maybe expand a property or as you replace an existing building, A lot of times the foundation walls are just too stout and too deep to really do anything with. And so they're left and you build above it. And then gradually the, you know, after, you know, several centuries worth of generations, you know, you're now 2, 3, 4, even 5 or 6 feet above the previous ground plane. Then the other thing is also that, at least in the ancient world, you would actually have people deliberately destroying things and then building their houses on top of that. We have an archaeological term for that, which is called a tell. So you would have just mounds and mounds of ruined architecture that would be, you know, cleared or burnt, and things would be built on top of that. And so those mounds just get bigger and bigger and bigger, and deeper and deeper. And so, you know, it's those kinds of processes that mean that things are just, you know, basically kind of dropping into the ground. I will say, though, that even though we don't have too many cities that are at risk of going underground, it is actually quite an interesting era archaeologically, because we do have a lot of cities that are facing inundation from rising sea levels. And so we are actually looking at an era where you might find marine archaeology looking at some of these cities that are being at risk of sea level rise, you know, are going to be a real challenge for people to study historically in the near future.
Yeah, this technology does work under water and under, I guess, the surface of the sea, right?
Yeah, some of the ones that like magnetometry, you'd have maybe some difficulty with, but sonar, for example, the exact same thing that allows, you know, ships captains to navigate coral reefs or military crews to map the bottom of the ocean. You know, you can use sonar to actually pick up signals of things like old pilings where maybe there was a village that was extended out into a lake or a pond. You can find evidence of things like ancient dams or weirs for catching fish. And those kinds of tools can be used for sort of non-invasive marine archaeology as well.
Okay, so almost by definition, historically, most archaeological sites have been explored by digging, which creates problems, right, if other things have been built on top. First, you have to have a property owner or a city willing to allow it. How hard is it to obtain that permission in the modern world?
It's surprisingly difficult, you know, as someone who's just really enthusiastic about archaeology and, you know, could hardly imagine how interesting it would be to find that there was an ancient building, you know, buried somewhere on a property I own. You know, I find a lot of landowners are actually very suspicious and quite hesitant to give permission to dig precisely because they fear losing control of their own property. You know, if it turns out that there is an ancient Roman villa on in the backyard of your family home in England, you know, it may turn out that the, you know, you may be scared that the heritage, English heritage might want to take control, or that it becomes in some kind of legal liability, or, you know, there's the people don't necessarily want to know what's buried in the past or in the ground beneath them. It's also true when you get to infrastructural projects. So if somebody's building a new subway line or a train route, or maybe even just a highway, a lot of times these organizations, they're often legally required to hire an archaeological team to survey ahead of time and make sure that you're not going through something that's historically priceless or irreplaceable. But if you do find something, you know, the penalty can be enormous delays. It can take, you know, another year or two to get a project done. The costs can go into the millions of dollars. And so, you know, there's a lot of sort of dishonesty as well in these spheres where people don't necessarily want to admit that they found something on their property. So the funny thing is that, you know, it seems like a no-brainer. Like, well, of course, we all want to study this stuff. It's fascinating. It's archaeology. It's ancient temples. It's, you know, people that we don't really understand or cultures that we didn't know about. But so much of this stuff is just sort of swept under the rug, and you know, people, you know, everyday people don't even necessarily understand the true riches of archaeological finds. And so that's another reason why these non-invasive tools are so good, because you can actually study things without having to excavate them or map things without ever having to actually, you know, destroy someone's property or, you know, for that matter, you know, jackhammer the cathedral in Siena.
And even when the will is there, this is all pretty expensive. When archaeologists have permission to dig up a site, who tends to pay for these excavations?
That can be any number of things. You know, in some cases, it's paid for by the state. So if it's, you know, it maybe found by a roadworks crew and the state of Indiana or that kind of thing is are the people behind wanting to document and preserve it, there'll be a tiny amount of funding that goes to it in that case. Other times, it's university departments. And many other times it's private funders. So there'll be foundations that want to give money to these kinds of studies, or they want to underwrite, you know, independent archaeological surveys, can donate money for these kinds of things. And so it can be a real scramble, though, like trying to find people that actually want to pay for it. One of the individuals in the article that in Wired that you were mentioning actually has an ambitious plan to start an entire new kind of agency that would be taxpayer funded and would be run by the European Union and would be modeled after the European Space Agency or after NASA. But it would be, in his words, it would be looking down instead of up. So the idea would be a state-funded archaeological survey that would basically scan everything and would use taxpayer money to achieve that goal.
So there are these emerging alternatives to digging up the ground and looking for structures and artifacts. This technology was developed, to look for oil and mining resources, right?
Yeah, there's a real irony behind where the tools actually come from. You know, they are used primarily by the extraction industry to find things like ore bodies that you might want to dig up in a mine, or deposits of oil that you might want to pump out of the ground. Or any number of, you know, geological sources of wealth. And these tools are very good at finding them. So there's a lot of irony, I think, in the fact that those tools are also very good at locating other things underground, including, you know, abandoned foundations or ancient villages or entire lost cities, you know, things that we actually want to save and preserve and study. But, you know, the tools are decreasing in value, which is great because, you know, multinational extraction firms have so much money to put into R&D and to put into these kind of visualization tools to see what's down there so that they know where to dig. But these things gradually trickle down and reach archaeological departments. And that's how archaeologists really kind of get a hold of this technology. You know, it is not made for archaeologists, but archaeologists have been very clever in finding ways to make it work for them.
Yeah, how did they begin adapting this technology for their purposes if it wasn't built specifically to find ancient structures or remnants of structures?
I think it's just a great example of, you know, technology transfer that they saw that this had value, you know, that they realized that people could look down into the ground and find features. You know, maybe it was an ore body, or maybe it was something like a fault that they were trying to avoid in a mine construction operation. And then archaeologists realized, well, wait a minute, you know, we could also use this for other purposes. And so the first known use of ground penetrating radar, at least in an archaeological setting, was actually in Chaco Canyon, which is in New Mexico here in the United States, where it was used to try to map ancient settlements, indigenous Native American settlements in the American West, and really kind of snowballed from there. You know, it was funny talking to many archaeologists who studied the field and these kinds of tools back in the 1990s, who, you know, they often pointed out that they're textbooks were 400 pages, and then there was like a paragraph or two that maybe mentioned the possibility of using ground penetrating radar. And I feel like the pendulum has really swung the other direction now, where, you know, it can be quite difficult to study archaeology these days and not come up against the, you know, the use of these kinds of tools, or new innovations in electromagnetic sensing technology that allows archaeologists to look without excavating.
So Jeff, what can ground penetrating radar reveal? Like, how do the remnants of ancient structures show up different from the dirt and rocks and whatever else might be surrounding them?
Well, that's actually a great question, because it can be quite difficult. You know, if you actually look at the data that comes back from ground penetrating radar, for a person like myself, you know, a civilian or just someone who isn't trained in interpreting that kind of data, it really honestly looks totally impenetrable. You get a series of hyperbolic curves on a black and white screen, and you have to deduce from how those curves are shaped, whether or not it's a feature, and if it is a feature, how deep it is, et cetera. So it's very, very tricky. And it means that, one, you have to be very well trained in the interpretive art of looking at radar data. But then, two, you have to have a very good software team. And so, you know, quite a large part of the new archaeology that's taking shape today is actually about software engineering. It's about people who can sort through, or, you know, create the code that can sort through imaging. There's machine learning. There's even AI is getting involved. And it's about recognizing repetitive features that can be, basically put together, and you add that up to the floor plan of a building, or you add that up to a straight line that might be a wall. And so it's a pretty tricky technology to use. It works basically by sending radar waves, pulses of electromagnetic energy into the ground, and it can go through, you know, sand and dirt. It'll bounce off small rocks, it'll bounce off large rocks, and come back to the receiver. But as you walk across a meadow and then you put together all of those reflections that are coming up out of the ground, you may notice that a straight line is forming. And then you may notice that that straight line goes to a right angle with another straight line, which would imply, you know, since it's quite unlikely that that would be a natural feature, that would be the corner of an ancient house or the corner of some sort of buried building. And so if you do that over a long enough landscape, a large enough landscape, you'll begin to piece together whole buildings at a time. You know, you can find where the streets are, where the doors are, where marketplaces might have been. And so it's also speeds up archaeology dramatically, because you no longer have to spend, you know, entire summer seasons scratching down through inch after inch of topsoil. You know, you can scan several acres in a single afternoon and piece together the information to realize that there might be there are actually buildings beneath what appears to be an empty meadow.
And can that scanning be done without asking permission of cities or property owners, as long as people are not on private property in most places? Like, can you just do this without really bothering anybody else?
I mean, it's funny. You can, in the technical sense of that word, but it would be most likely illegal. So you do, in fact, need a permit, which is too bad. But I have not seen too many examples where archaeologists can just walk into a place with a radar unit and get away with scanning it. You can do that, but then, you know, that would raise some ethical questions about how the data was gathered. So unfortunately, yeah, you do need to get permission, you know, which is one of the reasons why, to go back to the Siena example, it was only during COVID-19 lockdowns, when there weren't a lot of people around, that there was a permit was given to operate some of this equipment in parts of the city that would otherwise have been completely packed with tourists or inaccessible for reasons of just things would have been too busy.
So if we had been in Siena when Professor Campana was doing this work and had watched him from 20 yards away, what would we have seen? What does it look like as these scans are taking place?
Well, the funny thing is it kind of looks like a grounds, like a maintenance crew is coming through. You have things that look a little bit like lawnmowers and other things that look a little bit like maybe some sort of like fertilizing unit. You know, it's generally a kind of a push cart that you can push in front of you that will pick up radar data in terms of magnetometry, which is a different technology based on magnetic signals in the ground. That often looks like you're walking around with a tiny little, almost like a white picket fence, where each of the pickets in the fence are sensors or antenna that are picking up magnetic signals. And then when I was there in Siena with the crew, they actually had an all-terrain vehicle that had this huge pack of radar gear that was towed behind it on a kind of cantilevered platform. And there's no way, I don't think anyone would have come to the conclusion that we were doing an archaeological survey. If anything, it looked like we were driving some kind of street cleaning vacuum. And you know, you can drive quite quickly with this technology as well. So we were going 20, 25 miles an hour around Siena and still picking up high resolution archaeological data from the radar equipment that was attached to the back of it. But it was quite comical. I mean, I don't think people realize that, you know, very culturally important, high precision scientific measurements are being taken. It just looks like someone is trying to collect litter or, you know, just doing other kind of municipal maintenance. So it's easy to not see what's really at stake.
You were actually there observing one of these geophysical surveys when it seemed like researchers found something significant, right? What was that experience like?
Well, what I think is so fascinating about this is that as the data starts to come back, it's almost like a head rush kind of feeling, you know, because everything looks like it might be a feature. And so this could be a wall or that could be a wall. You know, this might be the foundation or the floor of a major building that no one has found before or that no one has excavated. And so it's almost like a sugar rush. You know, you get this sense of, my God, you know, we've discovered something no one has previously seen. We're standing in the middle of a Roman villa or an ancient palace, you know, that has not ever been mapped before. But then as you start to really kind of interpret the data and put it through software and apply different filters and, you know, put all the measurements to up against one another to see if features extend from one measurement to the next. You know, you start to come down a little bit and reality sets in and you begin to realize, okay, maybe this isn't necessarily as big a building as we thought, or maybe it's not even a building at all. And that's kind of the, you know, the ups and downs of this kind of work.
So the sugar rush really, can crash, basically.
Yeah, the sugar rush can definitely crash. But the fun thing is that, you know, another one of the people I interview in the piece, it's a ground penetrating radar expert named Lawrence Conyers. You know, for him, not finding a building isn't necessarily a failure of research. You know, the no matter what you're doing, you're still performing a scientific survey and you're still exploring what happens when you send radar energy down into the ground. And so even a survey that refines nothing of archaeological interest whatsoever is still scientifically interesting because it shows maybe how radar, you know, might act on a beach as opposed to in the middle of a meadow with deep topsoil. You know, maybe in an urban setting versus like a riverbed. There's all kinds of differences that you find in how different geological circumstances react to radar waves as well. And so you know, it's helpful to realize that even if there isn't something discovered archaeologically, there still is something found scientifically.
So it can be possible to get what amounts to a false positive, right? A sign that something may be there, and it turns out that the clues were leading you in the wrong direction. But do I understand this right? It's also possible for this radar to detect things that have deteriorated entirely, like wooden structures that have just completely decomposed?
That's correct. You can use radar to find things that can be extremely difficult to locate, actually, ironically, through excavation. So by excavating down, you might not necessarily find the wall that you're looking for. But if you see it through the lens of radar, you're getting the reflections back that show a linear feature across the landscape. That the other technology that I mentioned earlier, magnetometry, you know, which uses magnetic signals, is even more subtle in terms of that, where you can basically take, you know, just picture someone's empty backyard. You can use magnetometry and that will pick up signals of things like ancient campfires. It'll detect very small magnetic differences where maybe 1,000 years ago there was a wall and that wall had tiny particles of metal in it. If you were to dig, it would look like dirt. You know, there would be nothing that your shovel would pick up. But the magnetic signal is still in the ground. And therefore, when you map it, you can see very precise and very clean looking walls that indicate that that's where the building was. But it's not physically accessible through excavation. So it's quite interesting because it actually reverses the order of, you know, what's more useful for archaeologists. Is it excavation or is it digital imaging? And the imaging actually comes out on top. But so it does have advantages in those kinds of settings where it can find things that, you know, the eyes or the handheld tools of a traditional archaeologist would miss.
Why does Professor Campana think this work is especially critical for places that are not currently covered by special historic protections, not acknowledged to be potentially important?
I think the value of this kind of archaeological work for landscapes that are traditionally seen as maybe outside of historical interest or lacking in archaeological insight is that the vast majority of human beings throughout history, perhaps even including us, you know, are left out of the archaeological record. You know, we're everyday people who maybe didn't have palaces or, you know, tiled fountains in their backyard, or military generals, you know, who didn't have large retirement homes in the countryside, can often be overlooked by some of these archaeological surveys that focus on, you know, the major power players of history. And so the idea of investigating things that would be mistakenly seen as empty by somebody like Professor Campana is that we can bring, you know, let's say 90% of human history back into the conversation. You know, there are people that are seen as almost without archaeology. You know, their cultures weren't important. They didn't achieve much. They didn't build grand cathedrals. But in fact, that's a lie. You know, they may not have had the cathedrals, but they had complex societies. They had whole villages. They had personal lives. They had things that mattered to them and were sacred. And we can find those things now using some of these tools, and we can expand the narrative of human history and understand a bit better how we got here, what we've done, and also the people that we've overlooked in the process. While we focused only on kings and emperors, you know, there were millions upon millions of people living their everyday life. And electromagnetic tools like this can actually bring that stuff back into the picture.
To be entirely clear here, Jeff, it is not the case, even today, that archaeologists are confident they know where all the interesting stuff is buried, right? Sites get protected based on evidence, but there are plenty of places that have just never been assessed for the presence of archaeological remains.
That's very, very much true. In fact, I'd say that the overwhelming majority of the Earth's surface has never been surveyed for archaeological remains, either because of it's far too expensive to actually undertake that level of survey, or it's just physically all but impossible. You know, if you're talking about a place that has been like the Amazon rainforest basin that's just completely covered in dense forest. Or it's because you're talking about something of a more European nature where everything is covered with buildings. And so you can't actually get underneath anymore to see what's been buried. And so these tools allow us to explore those sites as well.
Yeah, I've always been really fascinated by those accounts of like these mega cities in Latin America that were essentially lost to wilderness for many centuries. It's a reminder that we could find evidence of our history in places that today we think of as sort of untouched by human development.
Absolutely. And I think that's another reason why this stuff is so exciting. You know, we really don't have a full picture at all of human prehistory, of where humans have settled, what they did there, what they built, what they believed, you know, the kinds of things that they might have made for one another. You know, maybe clothing that they made that have said that has long since rotted away. We really just don't have an accurate sense of human prehistory. And these kinds of tools allow us to see that. In fact, you know, one thing that's quite interesting is that these tools are also finding really interesting evidence in parts of Africa that have been seen as archaeologically uninteresting, you know, that the people didn't have grand cities, you know, they didn't build large stone monuments like they have in Europe. But that interpretation of African prehistory is totally inaccurate. And we're finding through the use of some of these tools that, in fact, actually complex societies have existed there. They've existed in South America. They've existed all over in places that we previously dismissed, even here in North America itself, where there have been settlements and earthworks for thousands of years. And it's these kinds of tools that allow us to study those more so than just excavation.
It's so exciting to think about the ways that this could upend the kind of hierarchy that Europeans in particular have placed on civilization.
I agree. I think that you know, it just opens up the story in a more egalitarian way as well, and lets us you know, see who else has existed and lived and what they did. You know, it brings in the story of those people. What they contributed culturally, not just to their region, but you know, globally, and I think these kinds of things are very timely, and it gives a really kind of unexpected, I think, you know, political and cultural urgency to something that seems very dry and technical, you know, which is the use of radar waves in archaeology, but it actually has a very interesting political subtext.
Tell us about this massive Viking gravesite.
Sure. For the article, I also spoke to a geophysicist named Immo Trinks, who teaches now at the University of Vienna in Austria. And he had been working with a group of archaeologists at several different institutions in Europe. But they were studying a Viking, basically kind of a burial island west of Stockholm, Sweden. And it's an absolutely beautiful island. You know, it's wooded, it's very verdant, and it also happens to include around 3,000 Viking graves. And so it was settled, I'd say, around the 700s. So that was about, what is that, 1,300 years ago. And a very rich Viking society, very dense, very long-lasting. And the graves that were left on the island usually took the shape of small mounds of earth. So a Viking warrior or a member of society would be buried in a coffin, and then a mound of earth would be placed above them. And that would eventually just be overgrown with vegetation and would be more or less indistinguishable from the kind of rolling meadows of a northern European island. But what's down inside of those mounds, you know, is the exciting thing, at least from an archaeological point of view. And so, you know, many, many, many hundreds, I want to say maybe even as many as 1,000 of those tombs have in fact been excavated, but it's the other ones that have never been mapped or cut open that Imhotranks and his colleagues at these other institutions were able to map to an incredible level of detail. At one point, Professor Tranks had this this great line where he said that, you know, we may not be able to see the horns on the helmet yet, but we can at least see that there is a body inside the coffin. Hmm. And so you almost have this high resolution, it's almost like a photograph or an MRI medical scan inside of a hill. And you can find the body of a Viking warrior inside a rectangular metal wooden box, which is inside the mound. And now imagine that, you know, just with 3,000 of those across the island. And it's really spectacular. And the images that come back from this are also just, are amazing to see, just to take an x-ray and look into the earth and find Viking bodies is a really, it sounds like something from a science fiction movie. It's quite amazing.
Jeff, how do archaeologists make decisions about which finds, discovered through non-invasive technology might in fact be worth a follow-up dig?
Well, I think if given economic funding, I think archaeologists would like to dig up as much as they possibly could. So, almost any site is interesting to explore if you have found something in the radar or the magnetic scans or similar. But I think that decision comes down to sometimes it's the landowner. Maybe a landowner will say, sure, you can use your radar device in my fields or, in some part of my property. But there's no way I'm going to give you permission to, actually dig things up or to, damage the landscape in some way. And so you just simply can't get permission. Other times it's actually about the responsibility that you then take for the objects that you have excavated. So as many archaeologists pointed out to me, once you dig something up, you've endangered it. So it had been underground and, it had been basically protected by all of the earth that was above it or around it. But now that you've dug it up, other people can come. The site itself can be robbed, can be vandalized. The thing that you've dug up is now, it needs to be preserved. And so now you're talking about museums, you're talking about archives, you're talking about all of the money you have to spend on things like climate control, cataloging. You get into this sort of administrative Kafka-esque situation where you have to take care of the stuff that you found. But I think a really good analogy came from Professor Campana at the University of Siena, who used the metaphor of a biopsy. His idea, borrowing that medical metaphor, is that every once in a while, you just have to dig because you need to verify that what you think you're seeing is actually there. And so there are times where you might have the most detailed radar survey anyone's ever seen. It might be 16 acres of absolutely, flawless high definition data. But at some point, you really do need to put a shovel in the ground and just make sure that what you're studying is there. Or maybe you have found something that needs to be dug up because it's quite an interesting cultural or architectural feature. And it's worth studying physically, to see what materials it's made of or some other bit of understanding there. And so it's a pretty complex question.
Yeah, I mean, there's this interesting conundrum, right? Because you have this idea that you might be racing against the clock and modern development ruining some of these sites. They might be further damaged by, environmental change. On the other hand, I think about, archaeologists 100 years ago did not realize that they weren't so great at doing archaeology, did not realize how much damage they were doing. Are there people in this community who argue for identifying sites and then leaving them alone, regardless of resources, for future generations with more tools and knowledge to work on?
That is absolutely true. Yes. There are a couple of famous examples. One comes from the Terracotta Army in Xi'an, China, where there are parts of that which are it's an entire army of terracotta human scale warriors that have been modeled. So they're basically statues of ancient Chinese warriors. And it's been slowly excavated over decades now. But there are parts of that that are being left until archaeologists with a better sense of excavating techniques can access certain parts of it without damaging, what it is that they found. But I think many archaeologists feel that way. I mean, if you read old survey notes or just descriptions of, for example, some of the most famous archaeological digs in history, such as the discovery of the ancient city of Troy, The damage done there is just mind-boggling, and really kind of sends makes my spine tingle. They just used dynamite. They just basically blasted the whole thing apart, looking and going down through many, many cities that were atop of ancient Troy. And that information is now just lost. We just simply do not know what was there. It was blown away by dynamite. Maybe some of the findings were just, went off onto the black market. And, the archaeologists there found Troy, but at what cost to human knowledge of our knowledge of human history? So I think that it makes a lot of sense, actually, to not necessarily dig everything up or rush in with a backhoe or a bulldozer because you think that you found something extraordinary. It makes a lot of sense to leave things where they are until we either know that we should dig them up or we know how to dig them up.
If we have a sense of where things are, is it possible to develop over those sites using modern building methods without annihilating whatever lies beneath?
It's definitely physically possible and architecturally possible to construct above important sites of cultural artifacts or lost villages and that kind of thing. The question is at that point is really about expense. And it's about, is there someone who's willing to foot the bill to pay for these sorts of things? One of the most extraordinary sites I can think of in terms of that is an ancient Roman temple, the Temple of Mithras, that's in London. It's right in the heart of the London financial district. And was, uncovered both archaeologically and sort of accidentally through construction and even some of the war in the 20th century war. But those have been preserved now, and you can actually physically access those. But, you're talking about multinational corporations that have untold amounts of money and can actually pay for these kinds of things. So it's really about the will of the landowner or the depth of the pockets of the people funding a project, about whether or not they want to hold on to something and actually keep it in place, as opposed to digging it up and putting it in a museum, or in some unfortunate cases, just pretending it isn't there and just destroying it anyway and building above it.
This didn't come up in the piece, so if I'm putting you on the spot, feel free to tell me. But are paleontologists using this technology in similar ways?
Well, it's actually a great question. One of the people who is in the article is an individual named Lawrence Conyers. And when I was with him on a small island off the coast of Croatia for this article, he's a ground penetrating radar expert. He was actually putting together a trip to Tanzania where he was using what he calls micro GPR. So basically very, very small scale, fine grained ground penetrating radar measurements. Because he was actually looking at ancient human footprints that were millions of years old and were found in, deposits of, I believe it was volcanic ash deposits in the ground. And so he's using ground penetrating radar to explore, human footprints from millions of years ago and piecing together, the story of maybe human settlement and human emigration out of Africa. And so it is absolutely useful for that kind of thing. Basically anything that is underground and that can be, mapped or sensed through radar, magnetometry, electrical resistivity is another technique, will be, these tools will be useful for that. So it can be archaeology, it can be paleontology, it can just be mineralogy. But if it's underground and can be sensed by these machines, then these machines are a good fit for that.
Did you have the impulse, Jeff, to ask to borrow this equipment and to go around surveying where you live?
I mean, absolutely. I think this stuff is just fascinating. It reminds me almost of, back in old sort of dime store magazines where you could spend 10 cents and get a pair of X-ray glasses mailed to you. those weren't real, but this has the feeling of being sort of real versions of that. Just imagining having my own ground penetrating radar device and being able to take it anywhere and see what's beneath my feet is really a pretty intoxicating vision. It just sounds so exciting to me. I'd say that my enthusiasm was tempered a bit when I was actually out there in the field watching archaeologists use the tools, because it's really difficult to understand the data when it comes back. The screen that you look at when someone is operating a radar device, it almost looks like you're looking at a close-up photograph of a zebra's skin. It's just black and white curves and parabolas, or hyperbolas rather. And it's really difficult to read. And so I would say that I would love to have a radar device, but it would just be a complete waste on me. I wouldn't know how to use it. Having said that, the market and these kinds of things, you know, consumer grade as opposed to, you know, professional grade or scientific radar, that market is definitely on the rise. And so you can actually go out and buy tools, you know, similar to sort of metal detectors that you can use to explore the ground and to look for things. But none of the archaeologists that I spoke with while I was researching this piece spoke highly of that market, or thought that it had dependable results, or even potentially wasn't just run by hucksters that are basically fleecing customers. So it can be really tough, but I do imagine in, you know, 15 years from now, say, it'll be a lot easier for everyday people to just go to Home Depot and pick up a radar unit of some kind and actually understand the results that come from it. So I do feel like that era of sort of do-it-yourself amateur archaeology will absolutely come, but we're still probably 10 or 15 years away from it.
Among those who dream of producing a kind of global map of what lies beneath the surface, what sort of collective effort do they imagine would be necessary to get this done?
Well, I think the most compelling vision of how this would be performed if non-invasive archaeology was scaled up to be a multinational global enterprise came from a University of Vienna professor, Immo Trinks, who actually wrote a manifesto last summer, in the summer of 2022, calling for the creation of an international subsurface exploration agency. And so the way he sees it is that if you can just economically fund this through tax, you know, you can create an agency that is not dissimilar from NASA or the European Space Agency. And you would just hire thousands of people to be using this equipment, to be operating, to be creating the software that would actually filter through the resulting data, that would be designing new machines, you know, to make sure that we can actually get into some of the places that we might not have access to, et cetera. You would basically just conjure into being an entirely new agency that would undertake archaeological surveys all over the world using machines that maybe aren't just hand-me-down machines from the oil extraction industry, but are actually developed from the ground up by archaeologists and with specific tasks in mind. And I think that if that were to happen, the benefit of this kind of research that I think is quite interesting and we haven't touched on yet is that it's not just archaeological information that you'll get. You know, it's very useful from an infrastructural point of view. You know, there are a lot of times people might not necessarily know where the power lines are if they're buried underneath a city, or, you know, forgotten pieces of infrastructure that were maybe constructed in the 18th century or the 19th century and have been buried, but we don't know where they are now. You know, so we can find tunnels, we can find pipelines, you can find things that aren't necessarily archaeologically of interest, but are useful for maintenance crews or that kind of thing. And so, in fact, it was interesting when I was in Siena, at one point, a gentleman came over and interrupted the radar scan to say hello and shake hands. And he seemed very excited about what we were doing. And it turned out that he was actually the chief of police. So he was excited to know what's underneath the surface of the city, you know, which makes sense. If you're the chief of police, you want to know what's happening beneath your feet. But so my point is that an archaeological institute that scans everything is not just going to be useful for a bunch of, you know, Indiana Jones fans. It's going to be extremely useful for city officials. It's going to be useful for landowners. It would have value that extends way beyond archaeology itself.
So I, of course, don't have the power to make the call, but having read your piece and now talked to you, I am on board. I think this sounds like a good idea. Why are there some archaeologists who think a global mapping effort might be a waste of resources?
Well, I think you get into a couple issues. One is the question of interpretation. You know, if you send people out into the field to use radar and they either misuse the machines, or they didn't quite realize that there was, you know, it's very sensitive equipment. And so you can even pick up things like cell phone towers that will actually pop up in the data because they're affecting the electromagnetic, you know, the receiver that's inside the device itself. And so you need to use software to correct for that and to get rid of the cell phone noise so that you can actually find buildings. And so if you send out teams that are badly trained, you can imagine a kind of nightmarish scenario where we've surveyed half of the planet's surface area, but we did it wrong. And so we have, you know, false positives, we have false negatives. The data is just a total mess, and we don't even understand what we're looking at. You also then get into some political challenges. There are some governments that don't really want to know this kind of thing, or they are, they have a vision of their own nationalistic past that doesn't include other cultures that once used to live there. And so they would not be on board with a large-scale archaeological survey because they don't want evidence that there used to be someone, living on their land previously, or that their arch enemy who used to live in the same place, you know, has a rightful claim to some aspect of the landscape. And so you get into a lot of different competing things there as well. And then there are also just archaeologists who I think really like to get their hands dirty and really like excavation and, you know, overly throwing this over, you know, throwing, basically automating archaeology and turning it into a discipline based around machinery. I just don't think is a very imaginatively compelling for some archaeologists.
Jeff Mano is a contributor at Wired, where you can find his article, Scientists Have an Audacious Plan to Map the Ancient World Before It Disappears. Jeff, this has been fascinating. Thank you for making time to talk.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.